Hi there, I'm Jim. Let's talk teaching. Welcome to Let's Talk Teaching, a podcast from the Center for Integrated Professional Development here at Illinois State University. I'm Jim G. Today, I have two special guests with me from another entire division here at Illinois State University, but it's one that is pivotal to the role of educating students and looking after students' well-being, their health, their wellness, and their success here at ISU. And we're talking particularly about the resources that are available for faculty to refer students to, and also talking about managing behavior in the classroom. So joining me today is Janice Blair, Assistant Dean in the Office of Student Conduct and Community Responsibilities. Hi, Janice.
Hi, good afternoon.
Thanks for being here. And Dr. Donald Reed is an Associate Dean of Students.
How you doing, Jim? Thanks for having us.
I'm thrilled to have you both here. We've had some conversations this semester. We're recording this in the spring of 2024. I've heard little snippets from people that there is this conversation on campus, and we wanted to kind of create a bit of a resource today for those who are teaching at Illinois State University to kind of just hear straight from you folks that run some programs, some resources that oftentimes faculty may be reaching out to in order to help students in their class or because they have concerns about the behaviors exhibited by some students in their class, and just to hear from you how they work and what expectations faculty members should have. But before we get into all of that stuff, and that's a lot, I don't want to assume that everyone really knows how the university works on every level. So our Center for Integrated Professional Development is part of the Provost's Office, which is in the Division of Academic Affairs, where all of the academic departments, communication, English, all of the colleges, the library, all of that stuff reside under that umbrella. There's the entire separate division called Student Affairs. So, Donald, can you tell us a little bit, what's the difference and what does Student Affairs do?
Well, the difference in between us, academic affairs and student affairs, is significant in that we do different things. However, we still have the same importance as it relates to a student's overall success. So historically, student affairs was created in order to control behavior, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Faculty wanted to teach. Let's take care of those bad students. I need you to get them in order, right? That was the initial point of student affairs. But over the years, over the decades, it has grown to be so much more. So while Janice and her staff still play a critical role of managing behavior, but also a role of development and helping students to learn from their behavior, right? Mm-hmm. We have to remember that students come here at age 18. That's their traditional age.
Right.
They are not finished being grown, as my son liked to say. I'm grown. Well, you're still 18. You still got a little bit more development to
right,
go, right?
Right, yeah.
And so Janice and her team helps them with that, as well as every other unit within student affairs. Not only are we looking at student behavior, we're looking at development. We're looking at diversity, equity, and inclusion issues. Mm-hmm. I like to think that although folks may pick a university for what they may learn in a classroom, mm-hmm. there's so much more outside of the classroom, involvement, living engagement, all of those things that help a student become a holistic person are things that I like to say that student affairs specializes in. And so we see our partners in academic affairs as critical because that's the work that we do together, not separately.
I think that was pretty well said. I think that we are really focused on the outside of academic support for the student. We know that mental health has also become kind of a bigger issue for our students of late. Their overall wellness, their engagement, that includes their financial wellness too, I would say. And so we're really working with people all across campus on developing students, supporting students in those various areas.
Mm-hmm. And I'm so glad you framed it as support, because back in the last millennium, when I was an undergraduate student here, I was actually a student member of the Student Judicial Board, I think is what it was called, which I believe SCCR, which is Student Conduct and Community Responsibilities, transformed into over the years. Can you just touch a little bit about that change of mindset?
Sure. And that is a nationwide shift that we have changed the nature of student accountability from a punitive kind of judicial approach mm-hmm. to an educational approach. We also see ourselves as having a role with student retention and success and helping them graduate. Part of that is helping them learn and grow and make decisions differently in the future, repairing harm that is done. So we also have a restorative approach to what we do. Mm-hmm. And so you will hear us really framing what we do as partners in education.
Sure.
And so we definitely see, as Donald was referencing, ourselves as partners with the faculty on campus.
Sure. We were talking before we started recording about the name of our unit here, the Center for Integrated Professional Development, and how people tend to initialize it as CIPD, and I flinch all the time because we're not the teaching police. Same thing is true. Student affairs is not the student behavior police necessarily, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind, that there are resources there. And there are always extremes when we talk about student behavior or misbehavior, however you want to characterize it. But for the most part, there are a couple of different programs I know through the Dean of Students Office that help students and that faculty can connect students with, can report students that they have concerns about. So tell us about those.
Well, there's several that we do. I do a presentation called Helping Faculty Help Students. Mm-hmm. And a couple of programs that I highlight is one, our Dean on Duty program. We have a dean available from 8 to 4:30 Monday through Friday that if there's a question or concern or anything that we can be helpful with, we encourage students, faculty, staff, parents, anyone that is connected to the potential success of a student, call that number. And our job is to either help you in that moment mm-hmm. or refer you to different resources on campus. And we have a fair number of faculty that call us, and we enjoy those calls. And we like to tell faculty, because we really believe this, that you taking the time to call shows care for your student. Mm-hmm. And so we really encourage that. In addition to the Dean on Duty program, we also have the Redbird Care Team. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, of how faculty can submit what we call Redbird Care Team reports to us. So if you are noticing something that seems uncharacteristic of a particular student or behavior that needs some attention to, you can submit that form. We get it in our office. Mm-hmm. And we have staff that meet across campus. So university housing, dean of students. We have representatives from the counseling offices, representatives from police and what have you. So we come together in a collaborative approach to see whatever issue is before us, how can we best serve the student? And we get most of our referrals from faculty, and we appreciate those. In mm-hmm. fact, when we look and check the list of what departments may report versus those that do not, we will reach out and say, hey, College of so-and-so, Is there anything we can do to build a better connection?
And there are public incident reports that can be filed as well. Janice, can you tell us about that?
Sure. And so first I'll address that it is not important for somebody to clearly know which report to fill out when. If you're not sure because it's a student that's having that behavior, is it a student of concern and I should fill out a Redbird Care Team report, mm-hmm. or it's an issue of behavior that may have violated a policy or regulation on campus such that you would fill out a public incident report. If you fill out the wrong report, we can bump the report through our system from mm-hmm. one to another. Mm-hmm. So that is not something that should be a barrier to people. So I did want to kind of bring that up. But our public incident reports are really meant for any student misconduct that would potentially be a violation of university policy or regulation on campus. And so many of us, thanks to our annual trainings that we do, mm-hmm. Learn that we need to fill out those reports for issues of Title IX that are brought to our attention.
Right.
Even if we don't know if the perpetrator is a student or not, that is our reporting mechanism for the campus. So that's a big one. But otherwise, any misconduct by a student or a student organization can be reported through a public incident report. Mm-hmm. Those are then reviewed by our office and routed appropriately. Again, if it's something that is not specifically a student conduct issue, we will get it where it needs to go. So don't be concerned about that.
Sure. Well, and I think that is something that has come up before in my own experience and also talking to other instructors on campus, that sometimes they may be expecting more immediate action. And we can talk in a moment about, you know, what sort of action can actually realistically be taken in certain circumstances. But they expect maybe more immediate action or some sort of a final report that something was done. So talk a little bit about that if you could. What as a faculty member, presuming that there was indeed a pattern of behavior in a class that you reported, whether it was something that was disruptive in class or, you know, I've often used the Redbird Care Team because, you know, regrettably, every semester I will have one or two students just kind of vanish. And I want to check on their well-being. They're not talking to me, but I want someone to reach out to them. So what should instructors expect in terms of a follow-up? What are you allowed to say about these situations?
Well, we try in every situation to respect the student's privacy. So while we welcome reports asking for help to look into a student situation, and we're looking for ways to try to assure staff that when they – or assure faculty, my apologies – that when they submit those reports, we want to say we have it. But as far as saying exactly what we did, we may be limited in that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are things that where a faculty person may call us and say, what is your process for this? I can talk to you about process, but I might not be able to tell you exactly what I did in that situation. So I certainly understand, and it speaks to the care. You submitted a student who you have concern about, mm-hmm. and you want to get help, and you just want to know what happened. It's not that we're trying to be closed-mouthed or secretive about it. We just have this thing called FERPA, and Janice probably knows what it actually stands for. I just know what it does. But it limits us from the private information that we can share about students and what we do specifically regarding their situations.
And we take a similar...
Well, I was going to say, do you want to tell us what FERPA means? Yeah. I don't remember.
Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act.
There you go.
I knew she would know it.
And it impacts a lot of the work that we do, of course, because that's educational records, which is not just academics.
No, that's true.
They're disciplinary records, they're behavioral records. All of those things are protected.
Yeah.
And we take that really seriously to protect that student's right to privacy. And so within the conduct process, or for at least the public incident reports, when those get submitted in, they get reviewed. It is not instantaneous.
Mm-hmm.
So those emergency situations, we'll talk about those separately, I assume.
Yeah.
But those get reviewed in a timely manner, routed as appropriately, reviewed. And sometimes we will have follow-up with the person who reported because we need some clarifying information, something's unclear. We can't identify the person correctly, all kinds of different pieces. And so it is pretty often that the person will hear from someone as a follow-up because not everybody is an expert on how to write a perfect report.
Right.
And we don't expect that. But again, there is a confirmation once you submit the report that it has been submitted and that it will be reviewed. Also gives a couple resources if you need to actually follow up, if you feel like you need that.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's a matter of you know, kind of trusting the process and that you've kind of done your handoff and that we appreciate that. If there is some sort of outcome or process where you will be involved in that as the person who reported, then you will hear from us because that would be an educational need to know.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we needed to loop back because there's some sort of outcome that would impact the classroom where the behavior occurred, we would need to involve you as the instructor if you're the reporter, or if it's outside of the classroom, then we might involve some other parties, staff as well.
And Jim, you said something critical. You said some faculty want something done right now. Immediately, right? And so that is all something case by case situation. So something happens. And as you were listening to Janice, you can tell we have a due process.
Mm-hmm.
Every student is owed a due process. So a faculty or another student may come and say, so-and-so did this. I want this done now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we understand that, but everybody wants to have their day to be heard. And and Janice's staff is very good about not only talking to the accused, we talk to the accuser, we talk to witnesses, we may get consultation from other offices, including but not limited to our police department. It is very difficult for that all to happen in one day.
Sure.
Now, if the situation is so severe to the point that we need to make an interim decision, mm-hmm. we have a process for that. Mm-hmm. And so if it's involving life, health, and safety of another student, those different types of things, mm-hmm. you know, there could be an interim decision that's made that our dean of students or vice president's office may make. Mm-hmm. But that does not lessen the due process that we have before we make a final decision. So that might be some of what faculty senses as a delay.
Right.
Not that we're dragging our feet, respectfully, mm-hmm. but that we're ensuring that every student rights and things are protected.
Mm-hmm. Well, and some of that perceived delay may also be we are working with partners both in student affairs and outside of student affairs on what is the best course of action given this scenario. Because
sure.
it's not always a conduct process. It's not always just through the RCT, Redbird Care Team process. Sometimes it's a matter of we need to figure out the best way to intervene in a situation. Mm-hmm. And that can involve multiple parties, collecting of more information. That can take some time.
And we also have to keep in mind, too, that student behavior that we're talking about falls on a spectrum. It falls on a continuum. And I don't want to say that my colleagues in the instructional side of things are – I think some of them that I've talked to have legitimately felt uncomfortable by the behavior exhibited by students and the fact that they, you know – what they have to do in the moment to deal with it, and they want that follow-up, and they want to do that again the next time the class meets. So I understand that. But it's also that if a student is being uncivil in class but not threatening, then they shouldn't call the ISU police department necessarily, right? I mean, there are other mechanisms that we're talking about here. I do know that there are a couple of situations where I've talked to faculty members who actually did feel threatened, or they felt their other students were being threatened. What advice would you have in the moment, and what advice would you have after the moment? And then we can talk about, you know, the academic affairs side of things too.
So I would say whenever I hear a concern about safety, mm-hmm. I'm not worried about somebody reporting it to my office or what our process is going to be. The very first thing I want to have happen is, are you safe right now? Are your students safe right now? How do we make that happen? And that is an ISUPD issue.
Right.
So if we're looking at immediate safety, that I'm not going to start talking about an incident report
sure.
form.
Sure, exactly.
So if we're after the fact and they're saying, I'm concerned about the student returning my mm-hmm. safety or the student's safety for the student to return, then that still may be a conversation with ISUPD, but it's probably also a conversation with my office and with the Redbird Care Team potentially. Mm-hmm. So again, that's why there's a lot of cooperation and communication that takes place.
And I would say in that scenario too, that's by that point, you should be talking to the director of your school or your department.
Absolutely.
And when we use certain words, it's very important to keep in mind that some words can be subjective in meaning. So when we hear, I feel unsafe, a common question that we may ask, please define that for us.
Right.
What is causing you to feel unsafe? Because that helps us to know the next steps to take. Unsafe is different from uncomfortable.
Yeah. Disrespect.
And disrespect. Yeah. I may not like it, but they have a right to say it.
Another word that we hear often that needs definition is threatening. I feel that I was threatened. Mm-hmm. A student using curse words or a student raising their volume is not inherently a threat. And so we kind of have to parse that out and help folks on campus understand what threatening really means. But that doesn't necessarily mean we still can't follow up.
Right.
It's just what does that follow up look like?
Yeah.
And even in those situations where the student code of conduct may not cover it or may not say that you using your profane word of the day mm-hmm. could get this done, we still get involved and
sure.
try to help from a developmental standpoint to where
sure.
we try to say to said student or said grad student or faculty, can you see how using this verbiage could have, you know, incidentally made the environment uncomfortable? And,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes we have success with that type of approach.
Sure.
Janice uses a word that I've grown to respect. We may decide to de-escalate, mm-hmm. rather than escalate. Janice, you want to explain that?
Yeah, I think one of the things I would love for all of us on campus is to do regular de-escalation trainings because I think that when we're faced with a student who is acting in a way that we believe is disrespectful, uncivil, some of those, how you might characterize them, we react. And that can be kind of our defense mechanism. It can be in defense of other people if our students are in the class or what have you. But sometimes our actions can actually make things worse and escalate the student's behavior. And so we really want to work with folks on campus on how you can respond in the moment to behaviors, to statements, in a way that will not escalate it such that can we have that student come back to class in a productive way and that they can get through this course.
Right. And my colleague Dana Carricker has we've recorded some podcast episodes about it. She and my other colleague Mayuko Nakamura have done some work on that here in our center. We will link to those. And by the way, for those of you furiously taking notes at home, we have a lot of this stuff that we'll put on our show page for today's episode. It's prodev, prodev.illinoisstate.edu, and we'll include links to the Dean of Students website, the Redbird Care Team, and those other resources. And so, yeah, that idea of de-escalating within class is kind of goes hand in hand with what we do here at our center, which is to help you kind of in advance, what can you do to create a community of learners so that those expectations of civil behavior are met, are engendered from the beginning and whatnot. So I always felt that our center is a great resource for the beginning of the process before the semester begins and as the semester goes along. There are, as you mentioned, things that can be done in process as well, though. So let me ask both of you, before we get into some final specifics about what faculty can expect and stuff like that, if I say I want this student removed from my class as an instructor, You're smiling, Janice, because I think you've heard that before, probably.
Yes, we have heard that.
What happened? Because yes, the student may be disruptive, but as an instructor, what happens next?
So I'll answer part of that, but I think Donald might have kind of a different angle. So we do hear that, and oftentimes when we hear it, it's at the very beginning of a conversation.
And let me interject. I'm asking that because I think that some of my colleagues go there first.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And that's not that that's a bad thing to be thinking about. Where that comes from is what we're going to explore. And so my follow-up to that isn't going to be, well, let's talk about those different options. It's going to be, what is happening? Let's look deeper at the issue, at the situation. Perhaps we don't need to jump there. Now, can you remove a student from your class in that session when they're being disrupted right now? Perhaps they're at like heightened emotion and need some time to calm down. Absolutely, you can ask them to leave your classroom. If they don't, that's a different situation.
Right.
And at that point, it can become kind of a security issue.
And to be honest with you, in past conversations I've had and when I've done consultations with instructors, at that point, oftentimes I'll say, then you just smile at everyone and say class dismissed and just cut your losses for the day.
Sure, and that definitely happens.
Yeah.
As far as can you block that student from attending class for the next week or for a certain time frame, let alone for the rest of the semester, again, we do very much value a process for the student. Mm-hmm. And no, that's not going to happen by your next class session if this happened Monday and goes to Wednesday.
So I'm going to reach back really quickly into my memory when I was going through the graduate teaching assistant training in the School of Communication. I seem to recall someone in authority saying, that if you had asked a student to leave on Monday, they were also not allowed to come back to class on Wednesday, that was a matter of university policy. Is that true?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay, and that's fine. That's important to know. That might have been something that was said to encourage young new teachers not to go to DEFCON 4 right away or whatever you want to call it.
Maybe that's in the same book of rules as you can leave class if your instructor doesn't show up after
10 minutes. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
And they always come on the ninth minute.
Right? Yeah, all right, yeah.
So one thing to think about, when you ask a student not to come to class, think about it, their education, they have a right to an education.
Right.
And so it is a little bit more serious than don't show up. We're thinking, has it reached the level that we are to the point to take away that student's right to be in the classroom?
Right.
Right? And so that there are different things that we have to consider before we get to that level.
Sure.
Because if we remove them prematurely, now we've taken a right to be educated away.
Yeah.
And then what do you do with that?
Yeah.
So not to say that that hasn't happened before. We've had a couple of times. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it's this semester or last where that has occurred. Mm-hmm. But we go through a clear process to ensure that that is the right direction we should go into. And it cannot happen in 2 days. I'm comfortable in saying it cannot happen in 2 days unless it is a very serious issue involving life, health, and safety of a student.
And again, at that point, then it would involve the dean or vice president to put interim measures in place. And so that would be a very formal process that we would look to. And that would not have to be something that an instructor makes a decision on within their specific course.
And let me correct myself real quick before I upset some people.
Okay.
Well, I said life, health, and safety of a student. Life, health, and safety of anyone.
Of anyone involved, right. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, another way to frame this is that teaching is about second chances. I remember even my nephew, who's now, he'll be 14 this summer, he's going to start high school next fall. But when he was younger, he had a hard time coming to grips in grade school even with the idea of making mistakes. Mm-hmm. And mistakes are, that's how we learn. You can't learn without making mistakes. You really can't. And so the idea that there are these social mistakes that are being made, that there are these, you know, in the context of civil behavior being made and whatnot. As teachers, if we can, do we not owe it to these students to give them a second chance?
Well, I would say, remember that this student is a lot more than who they present to you in your class.
Yeah.
That is a very small fraction of who they are. And even when we get into meeting with students and having conversations, we're still not tapping into the fullness of who that person is and what their experiences have been. So you're dealing with people, a lot of neurodivergence, a lot of mental health issues, a lot of past experiences. You've got veterans and military experience here. You have people who are experiencing trauma right now or have recently. So we need to keep that in mind also. And that does not excuse behavior.
Right.
But it certainly provides a context in which we try to approach that student and their behavior.
I would also add to that, because you had mentioned when students make social mistakes, right, we have to think about through what lens are we judging that to be a mistake.
Right.
So we talked earlier about the principles of diversity, equity, and inclusion, right? Mm-hmm. You have students coming from every walk of life, coming from this cultural influence, this social economic background or what have you. There's so many I can't mention right now. Mm-hmm. And so when you judge a person's behavior, you have to take a self-inventory. Through what lens am I assessing whether that's a mistake or not? But I also would like to add, the bare mention or purpose of education is to help individuals who haven't arrived yet.
Right, right.
So we can't make decisions that if they're already there, they're coming in as, you know, I have a mentor used to say they're coming in as a clay. They're looking for a potter to help mold them. Mm-hmm. So how are we going to do that? Now, again, there are certain behaviors to where I don't have time for all of that.
Right. Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Right. But when you get to a point to where you're assessing whether a behavior or a point of view or word choice is correct or not, you have to take a step back and assess what lens am I looking at this through?
Yeah. And again, we're not minimizing the concerns that some faculty may have if they do feel threatened or anything like that. That's being heard as well on this campus, I think. And there's a tension there that's being worked out, I think. And having this conversation, recording it, and having it as a resource is kind of part of that. Janice.
Well, I just wanted to add it's not just faculty. You know, keep that in mind.
Correct.
It's not just in the classroom. We
certainly
experience it in our offices.
Right.
Some of our offices experience it more.
Sure.
And And so, but that's also, our threshold is a little different. Mm-hmm. Whether good or bad, it's just a fact, our threshold is different and our training and experience with it is different. And so I would say that most faculty don't expect those types of things to happen within their classroom because that's not what the climate of an academic and, you know, environment should be. Mm-hmm. And so we definitely get that. It's more of a breach of kind of the behavioral expectations when right. it happens in that space.
Right. Two phrases that I've heard over the years as a teacher that I've really embraced, and one of them is this is beyond the scope of our conversation right now. Trying to bring a conversation back, those situations happen when in several cases, including when there's no behavioral issue whatsoever, we're just off track, mm-hmm. you know, and students are excited to talk about it. You know, I always try to let them go as long as I can, but at some point we got to get them the work. You know, I am the professional facilitator of learning and doing that. When I have had that initial conversation with students, I try not to call them out in class as much as I can. I try to get to them when the spotlight's not necessarily on them, in part because they may be craving the spotlight. And so I'm just trying to minimize certain things, move on. But saying that, look, I want to hear what you have to say, but I have a responsibility to everyone else in class as well. And if your behavior is preventing them from speaking or them from learning, that's where I need you to modify your behavior. Yeah. So those are two things that I've come to embrace. Because the other part of a university education is that we want to challenge ourselves and each other in the way we think. We want to explore the important ideas. We want to cross the ideological boundaries and, you know, we're all separated. It's 2024. It's another election year. That's, you know, those conversations are going to come up and stuff like that as well. And we can't be afraid to have those conversations, but we also have to set the expectations about how we're going to have them ahead of time.
And you're correct. We can't be afraid to have certain conversations. And this is Donald thinking. This is just my thought that I think in American society, we don't like conflict. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes when certain disruptive behaviors happen or present themselves, like you said, I would prefer to wait till after it's done.
Right.
But the situation may call for me to speak to it in the moment.
Yeah.
Because the students who are being bothered by said behavior, the other mm-hmm. classmates, mm-hmm. they might need to see that it was important enough to you to
yes.
take control.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And so in our quest to try to avoid conflict, we may gloss over it with humor. We may gloss over it with avoidance. But if you lead with humor in a serious situation, then the student doesn't take it seriously.
Right. That's true.
You can still be yeah. respectful.
Yeah.
But call it out in the moment, ask them to stop, and then I would recommend after you do that, ask if they would stay after class so you can speak to them a little bit more.
Yeah.
But avoidance won't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Being uncomfortable with conflict, it's going to happen. It's a part of our society. I think that is one of the initial ways that you could use in order to bring the behavior under control.
I would say it also can potentially invalidate the rest of the students' experience and their feelings that they're having in that moment. Because mm-hmm. if they are being impacted by it, you also
and you're not addressing
exactly.
it. Yeah, and we have resources on our website again, prodev.illinoisstate.edu, and we'll link to those about dealing with. I think we used to call it hot moments, but I think mm-hmm. it's now called like divisive discussions or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of not quite a decision tree, but it's sort of a step-by-step thing. What can you do to prevent this from happening in the moment, after the moment? And so we'll refer people to that as well. As we kind of wrap things up, there is one other thing that I wanted to touch on because I know from an instructor, a faculty standpoint, they are fatigued. We are fatigued because there are, you know, we're hearing so much more about student mental health, for example. And it's not that our faculty here do not have sympathy for that. It's quite the opposite. But there's a little bit of, now I'm dealing with AI. Now I'm dealing with political season. Now I'm dealing with mental health. How many more things do I have to be to these folks? So can you help me understand a little bit what you're seeing in terms of student mental health on campus? Because I know that it's being talked about in Springfield, it's being talked about in Washington, and it's being talked about here on our campus.
Well, I would just say, and I'm sure, you know, Janice has thoughts on this as well, mental health is a growing reality that we have in higher ed and in fact, at every entry point into the educational system. It is something that most Americans deal with, not less.
Yeah.
Right? Most of us deal with some form of mental health type of situations, right? And so it's something that we need to educate ourselves on. And so I would encourage faculty, staff, students alike, when there are professional development opportunities to learn about these, take advantage of them. Mm-hmm. We have a colleague on campus that does a presentation about neurodivergency. And it is so eye-opening to know that an individual doesn't necessarily think wrong. They just think differently.
Right.
And when you learn how they think, that may inform how you can best help them, understand them, and communicate with them. And so it is something that is going to be here and for the foreseeable future. I think we just need to take advantage of those opportunities to educate ourselves in that area.
So I would add, when we are having conversations with faculty in our office and kind of talking through situations that may be happening, we will encourage faculty to have a conversation with a student. That is not us saying, please be their personal counselor.
Right.
We still want the faculty member to have boundaries. Mm-hmm. That is very important. So what we will recommend to the faculty member, and we'll kind of role play actually that conversation with them, and point out when they're trying to go down the rabbit hole of being their counselor, and keep it on track for being empathetic, knowing what is going on so they can refer them appropriately. And so we'll provide more information about that. And any way we can get information about appropriate referrals, we will. But being a listening ear to that student is going to help de-escalate the situation in and of itself.
And I would just add, and you inferred this, is that's when we get tapped in.
Yeah.
Right? You know, so if you can deal with the opening moment, the initial incident, we can come in, you know, like wrestling. I used to watch WWF. Tap me in, coach, right? And then we can deal with it on a more longer-term basis if need be. We have quality case managers here on our campus, both on-campus and off-campus case managers. And we assign them as needed, and they will work with a faculty person or a student in order to help make sure that situation gets better.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Donald, Janice. We appreciate everything you had to say here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you, Jim. It was fun.
And that's all the time we have for this episode of Let's Talk Teaching. You can find out more about everything we talked about today. Go to our website, ProDev, that's prodev.illinoisstate.edu. You'll see the big Let's Talk Teaching button on the homepage. You can find this episode, and we will link to as many of the resources and past episodes that we can. For Donald, for Janice, for all my colleagues here at the Center for Integrated Professional Development, until we talk again, happy teaching.